Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Thursday, August 28th. I'm Jordan Pangelinan, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, the Redwood Peace and Justice Coalition raises $5,400 for the art program Life Canvas in Gaza. Western Rivers Conservancy and the Yurok Tribe completed the largest single land-back deal in California history, and the Humboldt supervisors revisit the cannabis grant program. So stay tuned, news on those stories and more coming right up. Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilcut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region. The Redwood Peace and Justice Coalition, an initiative based out of Arcata, recently raised $5,000 for an art program called Life Canvas, based out of Gaza, that showcases the Palestinian experience. Nat Cardos reports.
The Redwood Peace and Justice Coalition, RPJC, is an initiative based out of Arcata that has been working towards establishing a sister city relationship with Gaza City, and also has been able to provide critical support to occupied Palestine during the current humanitarian crisis. They have contributed to water filtration and delivery in the city, and during a recent fundraiser, were able to connect via video call with partners in Gaza for cultural exchange. Currently, through the Life Canvas art program, they are raising money for art supplies to support creativity for teenagers in the besieged city to showcase artists' expressions and perspectives. KMA News spoke with Sean Leon, the General Secretary of Redwood Peace and Justice Coalition, for more information about the coalition and what they do.
So our main focus is certainly on supporting Palestine. We did form after October 2023 in the wake of that escalation by Israel, and we were the main lobby behind the ceasefire resolution that did pass in Arcata. And now we're focused primarily on building a sister city with Gaza and Arcata.
The Sister City initiative that RPJC is spearheading isn't the first time a program like this has happened in Arcata. In 1986, Arcata became sister cities with Camoapa in Nicaragua to foster educational, cultural, medical, and technical exchanges between the two. The Sister City initiative for Gaza is to build connections between people here and Palestinians to bring aid. Leon explains further on what the idea of sister cities is and what the initiative aims to do.
Sister cities, the idea, the concept, it goes back many decades, almost 100 years now. And the basic idea is that citizens in different parts of the world join together and sort of use this citizen diplomacy that can exist between peoples. So city governments are actually interacting and forming links, irrespective of whatever disputes that their governments might have. So, for example, they were very popular during the war in Nicaragua, and Arcata even has a sister city in Nicaragua as a result of that. Also, they were a big thing during the Cold War, people saying, okay, well, our governments might be fighting, but we're not against the people. Let's find ways that we can express our commonality, that we can get to know each other. And very much in line with this idea that if two peoples across different, you know, from different countries, if they know each other, if they're familiar with each other, we're not going to accept our governments taking us to war with those people.
The Life Canvas project started when Gaza City Municipality reached out to RPJC requesting to fund the project. The project is a six-day art youth program that aims to show Palestinian life and resilience in Gaza City. The coalition raised a total of $5,400 for the project.
So the Life Canvas project began by a proposal from Gaza City Municipality to us. They asked us to fund this project, and initially we said, okay, that sounds great, but there's no way we think we can raise that much money in the time that you're saying that you want it. They impressed on us as the teens in Gaza City are wanting to be able to tell their own stories. They're wanting to be able to paint and express themselves. And also they explained that the people in Gaza are very much in need of medical supplies that they're not getting. food not getting, water not getting, all these things they're not getting, but also very much in need of psychosocial support. So this very much is in line with their goals to provide psychosocial support for their citizens, but also to build these international relationships that they feel is necessary in order to encourage governments around the world to not support the genocide against them.
The Interactive International Art Project has an aim to humanize the Palestinian experience and show living, breathing Palestinians that live in Gaza, according to Leon. The project is funded by local community donations and supported by RPJC and includes paintings, stories, video profiles, and photos to be displayed locally and internationally as part of a larger Life for Gaza program. Leon explains further the emphasis on humanizing the Palestinian existence and why it's important.
I think that it's important, some of the things that our contacts on the ground in Gaza have shared with us. They, for example, we were giving money also to this other charity, Giving Charity Foundation. They provided water. We provided over a massive semi-truck of water distributed around northern Gaza. And also Giving Charity Foundation does these cooking arrangements where they'll cook like lentils and vegetables and rice and different things. And then they'll distribute those to the people in need. And at one time, they actually were bombed. It was right after we had given them money. They had distributed the food that we had paid for, but then right after that, they were bombed. They lost half their kitchen. And, you know, if you can imagine, you know, just the grief and the heartache and the challenges that people on the ground face like this, got back on their feet, though. You know, they said, give us a week or two. We need to look for new volunteers, you know. And so, you know, I think it's important to have that direct contact. It does help humanize people. And that's really important because so much of the media, it disempowers us. And in fact, you know, that's what we were told by our contacts within Gaza City Municipality, is that they are actually going into Gaza City and they are targeting any ray of hope. Anything that symbolizes hope, they are targeting that. And I think that the reason that's important for people to hear and understand is because so much of what we see in the media is disheartening. It is disempowering, obviously. It is a cause for losing hope, right? But also it's so important that we not completely give up, because it may be something that we can do here. We can give up hope and we can turn our backs. But in fact, people who are living on the ground there, they don't have that choice. Giving up means not existing, and that's just not an option. And so similarly, we've been told by our contacts on the ground more recently, just past week and a half, we were told that there's over 700,000 people in Gaza City, and the Israel's government is threatening to invade the city, and they've certainly been making incursions even from before October 2023. But you know, this is a real massive humanitarian situation, especially with the United Nations having just declared that the city of Gaza, Gaza City, which is in the Gaza Strip, one of the largest, I think it's the largest city in Gaza Strip, is famine. And this is the first time that the UN has declared famine zone outside of Africa. And so incredibly dire situation. But basically, unlike about a year ago, when many of the NGOs and the United Nations pulled out of Gaza City in the north before the last ceasefire, in this instance, they're refusing to pull out. And the people themselves, we were told, approximately 80% of the population is refusing to leave. And I think that this is an incredibly historic moment in that regard, because it represents possibly one of the largest acts of civil disobedience in human history, where, you know, 80% of 700,000 people are refusing direct orders from the military. You know, these are civilians, these are largely women and children are represented. Certainly, if we look at the death rate, the death toll, overwhelmingly, it's women and children. So, you know, getting back to your question about humanizing the Palestinians, for decades, we have been told that Muslims are terrorists, for example, during the war on terror, so to speak. Muslims have been associated as terrorists, but in fact, in Gaza, you know, we're talking about a population which is occupied, right? So they're not in the same category as Israel under international human law, international law. Actually, in fact, Israel is an occupier, and they have certain responsibilities as an occupier not to oppress, whereas the Palestinians, in fact, as an occupied people, they do have the right to defend themselves, and it's just like the right to self-defense. It's essentially the same principle as the right to self-defense, only on a much larger level. And so you know, they are wanting to remain on their land, and they're human beings. And so, yes, absolutely, it's important. Through projects like building a sister city between Arcadia and Gaza City, we can show through these cultural exchanges that these are human beings that are being massacred.
For more information on RPJC and what they do, the website is redwoodpeaceandjustice.com. This is Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD News.
In May of 2025, following a 23-year partnership with Western Rivers Conservancy, the Yurok tribe completed the largest single land back deal in California history. This is a milestone for a river conservation and tribal sovereignty in the West. Over 70 square miles of land along the Blue Creek and the eastern side of the Lower Klamath River will now be in the hands of the Yurok tribe. The Yurok tribe will now manage fish, wildlife, and forest health within the newly created Blue Creek Salmon Sanctuary and Yurok Tribal Community Forest. KMUD News spoke with Josh Kling, the conservation director for WRC. Kling helps explain more of their role and what WRC did to help make this project possible.
I've been with the group for over 26 years, and my role as conservation director is to help guide our projects from a science perspective and help articulate the merits of our work across the West, as well as serve as a bridge between our different departments with communications and development and the lands team. The Blue Creek project is a great representation of the work of Western Rivers Conservancy, and briefly, our mission is to protect the most outstanding rivers in the West, and we do so solely through land acquisition. So we buy land and convey it to third-party stewards for long-term conservation management. And those stewards really vary from federal agencies like the Forest Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, BLM, state agencies like State Park, State Department of Fish and Wildlife, local governments, other land trusts, and increasingly, working with Native American tribes. And our Blue Creek project is our largest project to date. We successfully conserved 47,000 acres along almost 30 miles of the Lower Klamath, including a nearly equal number of miles of important fish-bearing tributary streams to the Lower Klamath. And this is all on the backside of Redwood State and National Park, meaning to the east. And Blue Creek is a critical lifeline for Klamath River salmon and steelhead as they're coming up out of the ocean and they get into the water temperature compromise, main stem Klamath River. They need cold water tributaries to help make their way up through the system. And Blue Creek is the first major cold water tributary coming into the Klamath, somewhere right around river mile 15 miles up from the ocean. And 100% of, for example, all the fall Chinook, all the Klamath River fall Chinook, stop at Blue Creek and lower their body temperatures by a significant degree, nearly 7 or 8 degrees Fahrenheit. And that enables them to continue on to the next cold water refugia. In this case would be the Trinity, and then so on and so forth. And that's how they sort of hopscotch their way up through the basin. So we were drawn to Blue Creek because of its vital importance to the health and the recovery of the Klamath River fishery, which is now even more pronounced because of the incredible work that's been done in the upper basin with the four dam removals and the restoration of fish passage to hundreds of miles of spawning and rearing grounds in the upper basin. But if the fish can't get there, that doesn't do a whole lot of good. And so Blue Creek is a critical rung in the ladder, if you will, of getting to that upper basin goal. So we're really thrilled to have to be a part of it. Our partners at the Yurok tribe are the most ideal stewards for these lands as one could imagine. And it's also restoring a significant amount of ancestral homelands to the tribe. It's the largest land back movement in the state of California's history.
Rich in natural resources, Blue Creek has been a long-term focus for the WRC. Through collaboration with local tribes, the project has benefited from shared knowledge and support, helping to bring it to fruition.
It's a multifaceted project. And again, the importance to the Klamath River fishery of Blue Creek was an immediate draw to the project, and the opportunity to work with the Yurok tribe, and who has the largest fisheries department in the state of California. And they have it written in their constitution, their tribal constitution, that to restore and recover and sustain healthy salmon and steelhead runs. So they are the perfect partner in this project. And Blue Creek was a landscape of vital importance, and there was an opportunity there to work with the former owners, Green Diamond Resources Company, who were looking to divest out of this holding. And we have a long and productive history of working well with Green Diamond and doing a lot of really great projects together. This was our largest to date. And so it was the resource, it was the opportunity to work with the tribe, and it was the opportunity that brought us to this project. Going back almost 20 years, which is incredible. It took us 20 years to succeed with this project. But just this spring, we conveyed the final phase to the Yurok tribe. And we've now successfully protected 47,000 acres with our partners. And that 47,000 acres is managed in two distinct units. One is the Blue Creek Salmon Sanctuary, which is almost 15,000 acres centered on Blue Creek. It's the entirety of the unprotected portion of the Blue Creek watershed between the forest boundary and the confluence with the Klamath River. The remainder of the basin is on the Six Rivers National Forest. It is entirely protected in the Siskiyou Wilderness Area. It's pristine, it's protected. And it was just this lower portion, which was not small, 15,000 acres of the Blue Creek watershed, that we were able to acquire and convey to the Yurok that are now managing it as the Blue Creek Salmon Sanctuary, with the sole management objective being to restore and enhance fish and wildlife habitat. The other portion of the property, which is the larger portion, about 33,000 acres, is now the Yurok Tribal Community Forest, where there's a balance between sustainable timber harvest and fish and wildlife habitat restoration.
Through the Federal New Markets Tax Credits Program, designed to spur revitalization in low-income communities, WRC tapped a significant and non-traditional source of private funding. Combined with donor and foundation support, including generous funding from an anonymous foundation, and a grant and low interest loan from the David and Lucille Packard Foundation, WRC was able to raise the needed funds to purchase these lands. Kling explains more.
This was a really interesting project in terms of the financing package. It's a really wonderful assemblage of different funding that includes loans through the EPA to improve water quality. It includes carbon sales with timberlands that will promise for significant amounts of atmospheric carbon sequestration over the decades. It included state grants, grants from foundations, as well as federal settlement funds. No federal grants, but federal settlement funds and loans. And so it was really quite an interesting and creative funding package that arrived at the total $65 million cost of the land.
Kling emphasizes that this project is not only aimed at restoring the river for salmon, but also for surrounding wildlife. The forests along the river play a crucial role in the restoration process, as the river and forest ecosystems are deeply interconnected, both requiring ongoing care and maintenance.
You know, I could talk on and on about this project because it really is wonderful. And we've talked a lot about the fisheries, but briefly, I'll just also touch on that this project is really important for the recovery of northern spotted owls, for Margot Murlet and Humboldt Martin, just to name three really critical species. And so we talk a lot about the stream and about the fishery, and those are really important. But the forest restoration that is included with this and the benefit to all wildlife, particularly listed and threatened wildlife, is really profound. And we're equally proud of those accomplishments. And Marvin Millet is a threatened species that is a largely pelagic bird, meaning it spends the majority of its life's history out in the open sea. But they come onto land to nest and to raise their young until they fledge to head out to sea with their parents. And where they nest is typically on large branches of old growth trees, because it turns out that murrelets, while they're amazing at foraging out in the open ocean for months on end, are not very good at building nests. And so they need the huge old growth branches, because the top of them are largely flat. And whereas smaller branches, they're mostly rounded. Really big ones, the top is mostly flat, which is a great place for them to build their not really sophisticated nest structures. And then they go out to sea and forage, and it's interesting, they come back up along the same river patterns. They're kind of like the equivalent of salmon, in that they follow river courses up to their nesting grounds, not their spawning grounds. But what's interesting is that the marble murrelet population off of Northern California, off the Klamath and Redwood Coast, is some of the healthiest relative to the other populations in the lower 48. And that speaks strongly to the productivity of their marine foraging grounds. But the limiting factor is their nesting habitat. So the more that we can couple additional nesting habitat with that strong foraging marine environment, the more we can grow and recover that murrelet population. And so restoring old growth forest characteristics in the Blue Creek Salmon Sanctuary over time should significantly increase the amount of nesting habitat and add in a very meaningful way to the recovery of Marburg murrelet. Another interesting species to touch upon is northern spotted owl. And unlike the owl populations to the north in Oregon and Washington and further north, spotted owls in Northern California and south, their primary prey species is the dusky-footed wood rat, that does prefer younger cereal stage forest stands. Whereas in up north, spotted owls, their primary prey species is the red tree vole, which is an old growth obligate species. In Northern California and south, they're preying on the dusky-footed wood rat primarily, as well as a number of other species, but that's their primary food source. And again, their foraging habitat is much more younger cereal stage forests, more age class is a simpler way to say that. But they still need old growth forests for nesting. And so creating this Blue Creek Salmon Sanctuary that will eventually mature to being old growth forest next to the Yurok Tribal Community Forest, where there will be sustainable timber harvests and there'll be younger cereal stands, is a perfect combination of growing out nesting habitat and promoting foraging habitat, which should also help with recovery of northern spotted owls in this area. Then the third species is the Humboldt Martin, which if you've never seen a picture of a Humboldt Martin, you should Google it, because it is one of the most adorable creatures you could ever imagine. And Humboldt Martins are a member of the weasel family. They are also endangered, and they have largely been pushed out of their range in the redwood belt. And they've been pushed east into the largely Doug fir dominated forest area. And the problem is that the Doug fir area, once you get east of the fog belt, the redwood belt, is much more prone to wildfires, including large catastrophic wildfires, which could decimate the population. So the more that we can do to grow up older forest conditions to the west in the redwood belt and promote Humboldt Martin habitat, the more we can grow their population in that wetter forest that's much less prone to forest fire, and therefore safeguard the species over time. So those are just three examples among many of how this project is not only benefiting fish, but benefiting forest habitat and the species that rely on them.
Kling concludes by highlighting the importance of working collaboratively with tribes, noting that they share common values when it comes to restoring and protecting conservation areas.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, working with tribes is so aligned with our conservation goals. Tribes want native species recovery as a part of their culture, and species recovery and habitat restoration are part and parcel with the work that we do. And so there's a seamless shared conservation goals when we're working with tribes. And that's true with the Yurok, and that's true with the other half a dozen or more tribes that we're working with across the West. We've had some of our greatest successes recently working with tribal partners, and we are excited to grow our work with our tribal partners again throughout the West. And Blue Creek is just a shining example of the great work that we can achieve together.
For more information on the Blue Creek Project or any other projects from the Western Rivers Conservancy, visit kmud.org under this story. Issues of fairness drove a Humboldt County Board of Supervisors decision to change the county's Project Trellis program, Daniel Mintz reports.
Having changed Humboldt County's Cannabis Business Assistance Program to help farmers pay back tax debts, the county is tweaking it again due to concerns that focusing on the debts disadvantages those who've paid their taxes. The county's Board of Supervisors revisited the previous decision at its August 26th meeting. The discussion centered on how to distribute a new round of state funding for the Project Trellis Local Equity Program, with the core issue being whether the program should be limited to paying off outstanding Measure S excise tax debts or expanded to support wider business needs. County staff cautioned that expanding the program's scope would significantly increase the administrative workload and could slow down the distribution of the approximately $657,000 in new funding. The current version of the program's manual, approved in April, restricts grant funds to covering past due Measure S and property taxes. But that has sparked concerns from some in the cannabis community who argue it unfairly benefits growers who are behind on their taxes and excludes those who have remained compliant. Ross Gordon of the Humboldt County Growers Alliance recommended that the board adopt the broader approach.
So the status quo and alternative A really limit the eligible uses of these equity funds to repaying county debts, Measure S property tax planning fees. Alternative B is the only alternative that allows these equity funds to be used for any type of business activity or other activity. So things like rent, compliance costs, capital improvements, et cetera. And I think it's really important that the county retain the option for equity recipients to be able to use funds for this purpose for a couple of reasons. One is just thinking about what is the purpose of this program. The purpose of the equity funds from both the state and county level is to provide support to individuals who are impacted by the war on drugs. If the decision from the board is to limit the use of those funds only to repaying county debts, it's not really funds that are being distributed to people impacted by the war on drugs. It's funds being distributed to people in that category specifically who happen to have a debt to the county. There's no eligibility for many other items that people need those resources for to be successful on the market.
Southern Humboldt cannabis farmer Craig Johnson said restoring the program's scope of eligibility will help the cannabis industry.
This money is coming from tax dollars that were generated from us, the cannabis community. And now we're going to take those funds and use taxes to pay taxes. And we've been saying that a lot in the cannabis business, that we're constantly using taxes to pay taxes, and we pay taxes on top of taxes. And more of us are falling away from the little bit of industry that we have left.
To address the staffing cost issue, while also opening a new funding opportunity for compliant farmers, Board Chair Michelle Bushnell proposed maintaining the tax debt scope of the program, but adding state licensing fees to funding eligibility.
It opens an option to cultivators that have done all the work, paid all the fees, so then it would give them an option to say, hey, that's something that we I'm getting rewarded because I have done all my, paid everything, I'm up to date, I've done all my compliance. The other way, they feel left out and they feel like they're not getting, they're being punished because they're current on everything. And it's very difficult and I hear it continuously. So I would like this board to consider that we add to pay state license fees.
Bushnell's proposal was supported by other supervisors and unanimously approved. The program's new scope also includes paying fees charged by the planning department. Also at the meeting, supervisors voted to withdraw from the California Cannabis Authority, or CCA, a statewide joint powers authority aimed at assisting counties with cannabis policy and data. The county's membership costs $28,000 a year, and Planning Director John Ford said the CCA has, quote, not continued to provide meaningful information. The CCA was initially formed by the California State Association of Counties to address issues like cannabis banking and enforcement, but in recent years, the group's membership has dwindled from many counties down to just three, including Humboldt. The decision to withdraw was unanimous. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Patricia Tinkler, and thanks to our reporters, Nat Cardos and Daniel Mintz. KMUD News is online, and you can find us on kmud.org, and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our news stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Jordan Pangelinan.